When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I am Jeannie Lee from the University of Arizona. Joining us today is Dr. Gideon Fujiwara and his new book, From Country to Nation, Ethnographic Studies, Kokugaku, and Spirits in 19th Century Japan. This book was published by Cornell University Press earlier this year in May. Dr. Fujiwara, Gideon teaches and researches about Asian intellectual and cultural history at the University of Lethbridge in Canada. In this book, Gideon traces back how scholars living in Japan's periphery of Tsugaru imagined a nation during the transformation of Japan in the late 19th century. So welcome, Gideon. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Jingyi, for having me. I've enjoyed listening to a number of interviews on NBN and learning more about, you know, new books coming out. And it's great to be with you today.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to hear that. Now, what drew you into the studies of Japanese intellectual history and why this particular region, Tsugaru? Because it's not one of the, you know, it's not one of those fancy places in Tokyo or around Tokyo.
Yes, definitely. So, I've always been interested in how ideas, thoughts, and beliefs shape people's thinking, how these ideas shape the way that people behave and act. And particularly as I was starting to study about Tokugawa Japan, I was drawn to intellectual history. I took a great Japanese history course with Namlin Her at UBC, and I was particularly interested in writing about Japanese identity formation. And so Professor Her directed me to study about Motori Norinaga, which really was really interesting to me. He introduced me to a couple of books. One in particular was written by Peter Nosko, Remembering Paradise, and it's about Kokugaku. And So this book had a profound influence on me intellectually. And so ever since, I've been studying intellectual history from the Tokugawa to Meiji period. And Tsugaru is just a fascinating place. I mean, it's really interesting to study about, but it's even better to visit. It's such a beautiful place. You know, you've got Mount Iwaki, you know, this very scenic mountain, a scenic landscape. The Shirakami Mountains of Aomori are beautiful. There's a distinct culture there. And while one quickly learns that there's a distinct dialect of Tsugaru Ben, And so the identity, the culture rooted in Tsugaru drew me as well. And I think seen from the centers of Edo, Tokyo, and Kyoto, as you noted, Tsugaru was seen as this place that was sort of deep in the northeast of Japan. And so even in the Tokugawa period, as you know, Jingyi, this place was sort of shrouded in mystery. So that aspect was appealing and interesting to me. There certainly are works on the region, obviously in Japanese and you know, growing body of works in English. But for the particular topics that I was dealing with, there was still little written. And so, all of these reasons drew me to study about Tsugaru and brought me to the place several times since about 2008.
That's amazing. Actually, a few weeks ago, we had on the Japanese Studies channel, we had an interview with Dr. Anthony Rausch, who talked about the difficulties of revitalizing the northern areas. Yes. In modern Japan. So with this book, it would be quite interesting to see how it was vital, as your book says, in the early modern period. So what can you tell us briefly what this book is about and how you first became interested in this subject?
Yes, of course. So this book is about a really interesting group of some 18 intellectuals who lived in northeastern Japan. They imagined a dual identity because they saw themselves as residents of Tsugaru no Kuni, so the country of Tsugaru, which was a domain. But they increasingly imagined themselves also as a part of a larger nation of Imperial Japan, the Mikuni. So this circle of intellectuals, they were quite socially diverse. There were many merchant poets, painters among them. They were the core of the group, but there were also Shinto priests. There were samurai, and there was one female painter poet who was also an important member. Now, the central figure in the book is Hirao Rosen. He was a merchant painter scholar. He did ethnographic studies, learning about the peoples of Tsugaru. And after U.S. Commodore Perry's incursion into Edo Bay, Japan, of course, opened its ports to Western vessels. And in 1855, Rosen traveled to the northern island of Ezo, where he visited the port city of Hakodate. So there, he had direct observation of the Europeans, Americans, the Qing Chinese who were stationed at Hakodate. And he came to see the realities of Japan at this time, situated in a global community that, of course, included the industrially advanced and militarily superior Western nations, as well as the Empire of Qing China that had been defeated in the Opium War. And so this realization of Japan's status in the world actually made Rosen focus inward. And so he would pursue his ethnographic studies of Tsugaru and other countries within a larger Japan. And a couple of years later, Tsuruya Ario, another key member of the group, became the first person from Tsugaru to register in the Hirata Academy. And so they're formed this Tsugaru group of disciples. And of course, their teacher, who was the deceased Hirata Atsutane, you know, of course, he wrote about many things, the ancient Japanese way and many topics, but the Tsugaru disciples were particularly drawn to Atsutane's teachings on spirits, the spirit realm, and the afterlife. And these theories helped, well, particularly Hirao Rosen, but his fellows also, to understand that the spiritual mysteries that they were seeing in Tsugaru could actually be explained through Kokugaku, the Kokugaku teachings. And so this is a way that they found a place for Tsugaru within a larger Imperial Japan. But there were scholars like Rosen and Ario, but there were others who were very active. Like there was one member who was a samurai who fought and died for the emperor in the Boshin Civil War. And then other Shinto priests of the group venerated the spirit of this fallen soldier along with other fallen dead from the Hirosaki domain. Some of these Shinto priests were involved in the Shinbutsu Bundi, separating the kami and the Buddhas in early Meiji. So some of them were carrying out the modern reform, and then others like Rosen, they were very resistant to the rapid changes that were happening. And so ultimately, Rosen and some of his fellows, they had been dreaming about this new dawn for Japan that would be shaped by Shinto Kokugaku. But instead, I mean, they were quite resistant to Meiji Japan adopting foreign models for shaping their society, particularly from the West. And so Rosen actually did not realize the community that he had been hoping for, but he really found himself disoriented and estranged within a very new and modern Japan. And so, that was probably a long-winded description of the book, but I do offer fresh new perspectives on the Meiji Restoration from the Northeast. We look at the diversity found in grassroots kokugaku or Japan studies. And like I said, artists, painters, poets, samurai soldiers, Shinto, ritualists all played a part in this history. I look at ethnographic studies and Kokugaku and the dynamics there. And I also look at the commoners' experience of modernity and how they struggled with changing times.
Now, one of the very important themes in your book is the distinction between country and nation, which it's so interesting because, like you said earlier, in early modern times, the place Tsugaru could also be referred to as Tsugaru no Kuni. And Kuni literally means, when translated to English, it could mean country, it could be nation, could also mean domain. And I love how just this struggle of translating the meaning of Kuni into all of its complicated nuances in English. So could you give our listeners a brief overview of why you make such a distinction between country and nation and perhaps domain, and how that ties to what we were talking about earlier, kokugaku, national studies, or native studies, nativist studies, I guess.
Yeah, thank you, Jingyi. This is a question that certainly gets to the heart of the book and some of my arguments. So as you accurately described, right, so Kuni indeed means it's multiple meanings in the early modern period. So domains, as you said, so when we talk about Tsugaru no Kuni, and we're talking about the domain of Tsugaru, obviously, the territory ruled by the Tsugaru lords, Kuni also refers to province and nation, and so in this book, I really get into the granular sort of the fine complexities of community, and I really try to shed light on the fact that people living in 19th century Japan, but particularly in Tsugaru, they experienced multiple levels of community. They resided in a castle town, which is part of, you know, Tsugaru no Kuni, the domain, part of a larger province of Mutsu, Mutsu no Kuni, and then, of course, within a larger proto-nation or nation of Japan. which they refer to as mikuni. And in this case, mikuni, I should point out, it's made up of the characters ko for koshitsu, the imperial meaning. Well, it's come to mean sort of emperor, imperial, and kuni. So the imperial country. I'll often refer to Japan as the imperial country or the imperial nation, because that's what the Tsugaru Kokugakusha, that's how they described it or identified it. But as we look at this history in Tsugaru from from the late 16th century into the late 19th, so there's this continual tension of a Tsugaru no kuni. The Tsugaru leaders are always trying to justify their place within the state. And the state, of course, is Japan. But there's this tension between the Tsugaru no kuni. So they are referring to their home as such, Tsugaru no kuni, the country of Tsugaru. The administrators of the Hirata Academy refer to these disciples as the Tsugaru-jin, or the people of Tsugaru. So there's certainly a very clear distinction, identity there, self-awareness that they're from this backwater, peripheral domain that's far from Edo and Kyoto. But again, there's this emerging mikuni, imperial country that they're looking at. And for them, Tsugaru, again, this is one of the, I think, interesting parts of this book. They're not simply imagining, other foreign countries, but Rosen actually saw, English sailors, American sailors, Qing Chinese laborers in Hakodate. So they're seeing the reality of, different kuni, right? And there's a great quote from Rosen when he after he visits Hakodate, where he says, he saw these Westerners and they're all conversing, even though they're from different countries. They're coming from different ships with different flags. How could it be that, there's no distinction between self or other? And of course, coming from a Japanese context or East Asian context, this is very, literally very foreign to him. But here I try to tease out what Rosen and his fellows are experiencing when it comes to kuni and nation. And as I explain in the later chapters, Tsugaru, as it becomes absorbed into the empire of Meiji Japan, it would cease to be that country, and it would become but it would remain as a distinct locale with its identity. But now the imperial nation is so it's so dominant as a basis for identity that I think today people don't really talk about Tsugaru as the kuni so much, but it certainly is a very real distinct locale that will persist for probably many generations after now.
And what about Kokugaku? What does it mean and how can we best understand it?
Yeah, so there's a really interesting ongoing discussion on how to understand and translate Kokugaku as you know. So of course Kokugaku is the study of ancient classical texts to uncover an ancient Japanese way. These are some of the translations that I talk about in the opening pages. So national learning was one. Nativism was a popular one for decades as well. Native studies is another. And in each of these, we can certainly see the strength of the translation, like national learning. Obviously, the nation or national gets emphasized. But then the issue with this one, of course, is that we may project understandings of the modern nation back to the 18th, 19th century in the early modern period. Nativism, as a few scholars have pointed out, there's a, I mean, it gives the impression that all kokugakusha were anti-foreign and were part of some anti-immigrant group, you know, which is sort of the meaning that, that nativism carries. Now, certainly there's aspects of anti-foreign or xenophobic aspects of some kokugaku writings, but this could be misrepresentative of the scholarship as a whole. Native studies, of course, is makes sense, but I mean, where I live in Treaty 7 territory in southern Alberta, Canada, home of the Siksikai Tetapi people, when I say native studies, people think about indigenous studies. So they might wonder if I'm studying about the Blackfoot or the Ainu of Japan, for instance. But the translation that I adopt in this book is Japan Studies. And Anne Walthall, a leading scholar on this topic, began to use Japan Studies, which I also adopted, which I think, I mean, it makes it clear that kokugakusha were studying about Japan. And so I use this in tandem with the romanized kokugaku. And so there's some discussion about this in the early pages of the book. I also have a co-authored entry with Peter Nosko for Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy, where we talk a little bit about these translations.
Yes, so that's one of the things I was really curious about when I just started, when I was like one chapter in, is that Tsugaru is such a distant place from the center of kokugaku or nativist studies, when it was most active in the Tokyo and Kyoto area in the late 19th century, mid-19th century. And this is also where the multiple meanings of country and nation come into play, because as a part of the Hirosaki domain, or the country of Hirosaki, technically Tsugaru was a country itself, right? And so is Hirosaki. So both of them became a part of the nation of Japan after the Meiji Restoration, after all the modernization. So how should we understand the nature of Tsugaru and its place within this larger category?
Yes, definitely. So in the early chapters of the book, well, chapter one, especially, I explain how the Tsugaru lords, the Tsugaru political leaders, and also scholars and educators from this region, they continually made efforts to try to secure a place for themselves within a larger Japan. So politically, the Tsugaru lords made efforts to ingratiate themselves with the ruler of the realm at the time. So in the late 16th century, of course, the Tsugaru lord was ingratiating himself with Toyotomi Hideyoshi, sending hawks as gifts, because of course, you know, Hideyoshi and other lords enjoyed hawking as a sport and a pastime. They continued this with the Tokugawa shogun later, sending gifts of young hawks to the Tokugawa shogun. And so this is one way that they ensured that their place in Tsugaru, and they did fight alongside the Tokugawa family in the Battle of Sekigahara. So they were rewarded for that, and they were recognized. And so increasingly, I mean, they would win honors and titles from Kyoto. And so this is their way to say, hey, we're part of Japan, we're contributing to Japan. And primarily they would do this not just through gift giving, but also in carrying out military directives, right? So if there was a conflict in Ezo, in the northern island, with the Russians, they would send their troops ordered by the Tokugawa shogunate. Also, the indigenous peoples of the north, the Ainu, I mean, they faced quite oppressive policies under the Tokugawa state and the Matsumae lords. And so when there were uprisings on the northern island, again, Hirosaki and other northeastern domains were called on to send their troops, which the Tsugaru lords did. And so they continued to make this effort. And for the Tsugaru group, for Hira Rosen and Tsuriya Ario, they found a means to situate themselves within Japan through Hirata Kokugaku. So this was a way that they found these really persuasive theories on the spirit realm. And so they saw that when they heard of spirits of the dead walking about in the town, or unexplained phenomena happening in their locale, they found answers in Hirata Atsutane's theories that indeed they were part of a larger spiritual landscape of Imperial Japan. So Tsugaru was known as a kuni for centuries, but it was absorbed into the Imperial nation. And certainly Mark Ravina also makes this argument. But as I noted earlier, Tsugaru would cease to be the kuni, but would live on as a distinct locale within the modern construction of Aomori Prefecture within Tohoku, the northeast, right, which becomes a constructed identity in itself within a larger Japan.
And to just briefly unpack this idea of Kokugaku, nativist studies, how influential was it at this time, and how did it, how was it spread all the way to Tsugaru?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of scholarship coming out on this, and in the early 2000s, there was sparked a Hirata boom, a boom in Hirata Kokugaku studies, and this is owing to the Hirata family, descendants of Atsutane, making public over 10,000 pieces of documents, letters, artifacts of the Hirata family, and really making public their valuable documents. And so, since the early 2000s, there's been so much work. So the Hirata Shrine was involved with that, of course, Miyachi Masato, professor, led a lot of this work, and many scholars working with him. And I was very fortunate to be granted permission to attend the Hirata seminar hosted by Hirata Shrine in Yoyogi, Tokyo. So I have to mention that, I took the midnight bus, from Hirosaki when I was studying there to Tokyo. Some really early mornings, but attending that seminar in the Hirata Shrine, it certainly I felt the power of scholarly networks, right? Because then great scholarly exchange, a great meals with these colleagues and mentors, and then hop on the bus back to Hirata for another midnight bus ride. But yes, there's all this scholarly activity. Numerous books came out, and so we know a lot about just the spread of this Hirata Academy from Edo, Tokyo, all across Japan. A lot of this is thanks to Hirata Kanetane, the adopted son of Atsutane, who was just a meticulous letter writer, Miyachi Sensei describes Kanetane as superhuman, and just writing numerous letters a day between Edo and places like Tsugaru to encourage the growth of these disciple communities across. And of course, places like Shinano, they had some of the hotbeds of disciples, like hundreds of them. And a place like Tsugaru was important to the academy in Edo because they wanted to ensure that even the far reaches of Honshu were receiving the teachings on the ancient way. And so people like Tsuriya Ario, he was the leader. He ensured that they were getting the books from the Hirata Academy, And of course, the center, the Hirata family, were enthusiastic, and they made every effort to make sure that the edge of Japan was getting the teachings. And Kanetane seemed to have a soft spot in his heart for Tsugaru, because they were neighbors of Akita, which is the home of Atsutane and the Hirata family. So, in the letters, Kanetane will often say, Akita seemed to have a good harvest. How was the harvest for you? And so there were those linkages as well, which actually was significant in the Meiji Restoration, because Akita domain and Tsugaru domain, they were fighting on the same side, right, for the emperor. But it was 1857 that Tsuru Yarryo joined the academy, and then from him, other, you know, his fellows joined in, and there's much to be said about the literary circle as well, because he was bringing in basically literary salon, or the poets of his circle, in already established networks. So there's so much going on there, and I'll continue to write about some of that that's happening. These intellectuals tapping into the rich network of Hirata Kokugaku were actually coming from their own rich networks and rich literary traditions that included, of course, poetry and ethnographic studies to begin with.
Well, I can't wait to read about your next book on literati network, for obvious, not selfish reasons. Now, two of the figures that your study focuses on, Hirao Losen, a painter and ethnographic researcher, as well as Tsuruya Ariyo, a poet. Can you tell us more about these two figures and what their roles were in the regional development of Kokugaku? Because as I understand that your book is the first detailed introduction of this person, Hirao Losen. So what should we know about them in this whole Kokugaku spread boom?
Yes. As you rightly point out, Tsuru Yarryo, Hirao Losen, they're the two most important individual figures of the book. And Tsuru Yarryo, it was really exciting to discover or rediscover both of them, and to be able to introduce them to readers. So Tsuru Yarryo, he was a merchant class poet. So he was quite busy already studying waka poetry, haiku, even before really fully engaging with Hirata Kokugaku. And I got to know him more intimately when I rediscovered the Kaganabe journal that he wrote. And I have a chapter on this in an edited volume published by Brill in 2015 as well. But of course, I write about this in the book, that Ariyo, so he was a poet, and in 1857 joined the Hirata Academy. And it's really shortly after, so it's around the time that he becomes a Hirata disciple officially, that he starts writing the journal as well. So I write about this as his scholarly rebirth, right? Intellectual rebirth. And he'll continue to write the journal really to the end of his life in 1871. It's not just a personal account, but it's a very public account. I mean, he expects that it'll be read by his fellows, and probably by his successors. And I guess it took a while until I read it, over a century later. But Ariyo was important as an administrator. He ordered books from the Edo Academy. Again, he wrote numerous letters, exchange letters with Kanetane, and then later Hirata Nobutane as well. And he was indeed a part of a salon of poets. And so, yeah, he was the leader that enabled the growth of Hirata Kokugaku in his area. And the academy required recommenders or references. They needed somebody to vouch for people that wanted to join. Not unlike scholarship today, right? We are all indebted to these people that made open doors for us. And so Ario was the recommender for a lot of his fellows, which is interesting. And Hirao Rosen was a very dear friend to Ario. They were both born in 1808. They were classmates under different tutors. They were both of merchant class. They were really close friends. Interestingly, though, Rosen, it took a while for him to actually join the academy. And my explanation for this is that Rosen was so immersed in his own ethnographic studies, he wanted to get his studies on Tsugaru right before he fully immersed into becoming a Hirata disciple a few years after Ario and others. But the other argument that I make is that Ario and his fellow poets, I mean, they were quite well-versed in waka and haikai poetry, and Rosen was less confident in his poetry, so he didn't seem to jump right in, among the circle of poets. I think he wanted to get his ethnographic work done. But Rosen would also embrace Hirata Kokugaku because, again, it explained that, thunder and lightning was not just caused by forces of nature, but the kami and the spirits were responsible for lightning and other natural phenomena, the workings of spirits, the sighting of bright objects that flew across the sky and fell into Hirosaki domain, Hirosaki castle. So, Hirata Kokugaku answered a lot of the questions that he had about these mysteries. And, Rosen is such an interesting figure. The book, I'm so grateful to Cornell East Asia Studies and Cornell University Press. They did a tremendous job with the images as well as the text and the editing. So there are a lot of images, some of them color in the book. And I think they present Rosen's artwork and, make it public to the world, like the cover as well. They did a terrific job with a painting that was originally done by Rosen, but copied later by his disciple, Sato Senshi. And you can see Rosen depict the Nebuta Festival of the summer so vibrantly and lively. And I think that Rosen's attention to detail, like he scolded his disciple for trying to draw a Chinese children without actually observing children, themselves, right? So, he says, observe the children closely and then draw a likeness of them. And I think that this approach to being faithful to what you're seeing objectively is something that he seemed to practice in his ethnographic studies, but also in his kokugaku. So there is some, I think I would say, integrity in the work that he does. He's not simply, influenced by ideological sway, but he does maintain some honesty in his approach. There's lots more to say about Rosen, but maybe I'll leave it at that for now.
Yeah, we'll leave it for the listeners to actually read your book to find out. And since you mentioned this briefly, how does the notion of sacred place and spirituality tie into their version of Tsugaru as a part of the nation of Japan?
Yeah, so this is these are ideas that I talk about in the context of Mount Iwaki. So Mount Iwaki is this sacred pillar of Tsugaru. It's this mountain, you know, beautiful mountain that's visible from any part of Tsugaru on a clear day. And the Ariyo, particularly Tsuruya Ariyo, he writes about Mount Iwaki of Tsugaru as a pillar that connects heaven and earth. Mount Iwaki is the abode of kami that protect Tsugaru. I do cite Alain Grappard's work on sacred space, as you made reference to. So in this context, I do talk about the mountain, the sacred Mount Iwaki, which the idea of sacred site and sacred region encompass from Grappard's work. And so the expansion of, or the historical process that Grappard describes, whereby the sacred space expands from the sacred site to a sacred nation, I think this applies to the story of the Tsugaru group, because this view aligns with their efforts, their grassroots efforts, from the locale outward to Japan. So Tsugaru, Mount Iwaki, indeed, Ariyo describes as a pillar, as a wall to protect Tsugaru from external forces. I think in that way, we're talking about Kokugaku here, not so much as like from the center to the periphery, but for Ariyo, if anything, it was from, well, the periphery, if you will call it that, to the center of Japan. That was a useful lens through which to understand Tsugaru's place again in Japan.
Now, the Meiji Restoration and the pursuit for modernity brought drastic changes to the Japanese society, and I imagine these worship of spirituality may have faced challenges as well. So in Tsugaru, Kokugaku scholars had to face the social changes and adapt to being a part of a new and modern nation. Can you talk more about this part?
Yes. So the last chapter of the main body, so chapter 8, looks at this exact topic. Let me describe it through the experiences of a few of these players. So first and foremost, I mean, Hirao Rosen, he celebrates the Meiji Restoration. One way that he does this is through his compilation of the Meiji Nikki, which is one of these fusetsudome, the collections of political documents, you know, compiled in one volume or multiple volumes in his case. So I write about this in the book, of course, but also in the Journal for Japanese Studies. So Rosen celebrating the restoration of the emperor's rule. And like other kokugakusha across Japan, I mean, he's dreaming of this new dawn. But then in the early years of Meiji, he realizes that, hey, what's happening to Kokugaku and Shinto? I mean, you know, and he's quite disappointed to hear that, after a meteoric rise of enrollment and this is really astonishing. In the first 4 years of Meiji, I mean, there are a couple thousand disciples that join the academy, And all told, there are over 4,200 that join the Hirata Academy. And again, a lot of this is happening in the first 4 years of Meiji, during this sort of quest for this Yoake, the new dawn. Just as it rises rapidly, there's a sharp descent after 1871. And Rosen is lamenting that, you know, people are flocking now to Western learning, Dutch studies, and the, of course, Western learning has a growing following in Hirosaki, in part due to American missionaries that are coming to teach and the many young samurai who are converting to Christianity. He's seeing that, okay, yeah, the the new dawn is not materializing like he was hoping. Shimozawa Yasumi, a really interesting figure in the book as well. He's called on to compile histories and poetry anthologies for the former daimyo. And so he's working, you know, for the local government as well. Shinto priests, like I noted, you know, they're trying to carry out so-called religious reform, trying to reconstruct a new Shinto free of a Buddhist influence. So they're implicated in the modern state building, but then they're also caught up in the struggle because they represent the local religious tradition. And they're sort of caught in between the local shrines and the directives from Tokyo and Kyoto. And Kanahira Kiryo, a really interesting, the lone woman in the group. She a really fascinating figure. I mean, she was a painter, a poet, in a male-dominated realm of scholarship and kokugaku, you know, she certainly asserted her voice. There was a bit of, when she registered, she obviously had the support of her fellows in Hirosaki, but, the Hirata administrators were, you know, doing a double take. They were asking, you know, who is this? Who is this kind of, you know, is she a woman? Is she really a woman? And, you know, there's a bit of a stir there. But of course, she was accepted into the academy, one of only 27 women out of those, you know, 4,000 plus. But she would also navigate changing times in Meiji. You can see that some of them were carrying out the modern reforms. Some of them were resistant to it. And, you know, the death of Tsuruya Ario in 1871 is significant because they lost their leader. And as I describe in the late pages of the book, some of their earlier activities would cease, but they would truly become a part of a modern nation. There was some excitement, but also disorientation, estrangement within, you know, sort of this new and foreign new Meiji society. There were also local appropriations of the kokugaku work that was done support some of the modern military successes when, you know, Japan and China go to war in the first Sino-Japanese War. So, you know, long after Ario and Rosen are gone, there are modern appropriations of what kokugaku now means to the modern empire, which are rather ahistorical and nationalistic. A grappling with modernity and a struggle and sort of trying to represent what some of these commoner intellectuals were experiencing during these rapidly changing times.
And given the association between nativist studies and nationalist characteristics, and plus this region of Tsugaru Hirosaki, I don't imagine it to be a easy task. So what kind of difficulties did you run into when you were doing your research for this book?
Yes. The project certainly began as my doctoral research and dissertation. And I was really fortunate that Yasunori Kojima introduced me to the Tsugaru Kokugaku, which I jumped at because it's not about the Kokugaku canon. It's not about the big figures, right? The Ushi, the masters whose works are many of whose works are published in edited complete works and such. But so that's where one of the challenges lay, that it's a new topic with archival sources. So there's a great opportunity there, but certainly lots of work finding them. So I was really fortunate to spend just over a year in Hirosaki, based at Hirosaki University, where they hosted me. And I truly benefited from a generous Japan Foundation doctoral fellowship, as well as a Social Science and Humanities Research Council of Canada fellowship. I spent many of my days at Hirosaki City Library, bothering the librarians for, one document after another. And some of those finds were like the Kaganabe Journal of Ario, which is just a huge gem. The Waka collection of Hirao Rosen was another one. So finding these sources, deciphering the handwriting, and really getting help from a lot of mentors in doing so, it took many months. And then, of course, making sense of all of this, situating this locale within Japan. So every time I presented on the work, people always asked, oh, so what's so special about Tsugaru? What's so unique about it? What's so special about Rosen? So always having to sort of figure out, why they were important, and their continual attempt to try to locate their country within a larger nation of Japan was the story that I uncovered. And it's a local story, but it's also, obviously there's national elements to it. So I think it does certainly speak to conversations around multiple, multi-level community, nation, nationalism. But it's also a very global story as well. And of course, a lot of personal stories along the way. So I think that readers will probably be drawn by the provocative title. And hopefully they'll maybe learn something new, but something that will connect to, what they've learned about maybe around the globe, about the globe at the time, and also about Japan.
That's fascinating, and I definitely learned a lot about that.
Thank you very much for the plug.
Well, thank you for this wonderful conversation. It's really thought-provoking, and I absolutely enjoyed your book.
Thanks so much, Yingyi, and thank you for your thoughtful questions. And I really enjoyed our conversation today.
For our listeners, this is Dr. Gideon Fujiwara and his new book, From Country to Nation, Ethnographic Studies, Kokugaku and Spirits in 19th Century Japan. I am Jin Yi, and I will see you in our next episode.